Olivia stared at everything in front of her. The bottles, the cups, the hot tub teeming with young execs, some of whom were already starting to come out and help themselves to the bonanza. She felt frozen, not cold, despite the fact that she was only wearing a bikini, but stuck. She was still berating herself for slipping up with Adam upstairs. She can't go saying things that go running through her head. Not to a coworker who she's going to spend the next 2 weeks with and have to face again afterwards. Not to the guy her roommate clearly called dibs on earlier. Had he known what she'd almost said? She couldn't believe that she'd even thought it. She should just go back upstairs to bed. A cup was placed in her hands. Fizzy Coke. With what? She sniffed it. Coke. She looked to see up to see Adam grabbing another red cup for himself. She felt stupid, but had to ask. What did you just hand me? He poured himself a generous bit of bourbon before answering. Just Coke. She frowned. You don't mix good bourbon with anything, he said, as if that cleared things up. He cocked his head towards the hot tub. She took a sip of her Coke and followed him. There was no room for them, not technically, but Laurie waved them over, waved at Adam, Olivia, corrected, and told Eddie to make room for them. Eddie obliged as much as possible, but there was no way they'd fit. Adam shook his head. It's all good. It's too hot to get in all the way. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Guild Podcast and my little nook here in the world. I am your host, Chris Mary Holtzman, and as the world is slowly waking up again or returning, obviously the world is not going to be the same place. We're all probably going to have to live with the consequences of this pandemic for a long time. We just have to be more careful with each other. Today I have a very special guest, Allison Martin, and she is, as we talk about, maybe a genre fiction author to begin with, that has released a romance kind of on a dare. We talk a lot about that. It's called Dibs. It's a very nice interview. Very happy to have her on. Let's go to that interview. Well, at this time, I would like to welcome Allison Martin to the Guild Podcast and to my little nook of the world. Hi, Allison. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Christopher. Thank you for having me, and thank you to the Guild.
We were talking before we started recording about the chaos of home life and in this current situation. How is it over by you in California?
Well, it's gotten a little bit crazier because as of last night, our phone started buzzing. They put a curfew in. So this isn't even related to everything going on with the coronavirus. But there's been so much civil unrest that all the local cities have instituted a 10 o'clock curfew. And I think that's the first time I've ever heard my phone go off for something that wasn't a flash flood warning. Oh. So that was really terrifying, but I don't think anything big is actually happening. It's more of a preventative thing.
Okay.
So crazy enough that we have the coronavirus and monkeys stealing the coronavirus from labs in India. We now have a police-ordered curfew from 10 a.m. to 6 a.m., or 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., and I don't know if that was just for last night or if that's going to be an ongoing thing. I try not to leave anyway, but still, it's just one more thing to make me not sleep at night.
Yeah. I mean, if there was any time that there are actually, like, signs of a apocalypse, then I think it is what's been happening these last couple of months would be it.
Exactly. If anyone's playing Apocalypse Bingo, they probably have near bingo, especially with the free square. So yeah.
I remember I was talking to a student, and I think this must have been in December. So this was even before like the coronavirus was like a global thing. And he's of Muslim background. So we obviously he was asking me, he's like, what do you think about all these crazy things happening? Because there were, you know, the bushfires in Australia. There was a swarm of locusts somewhere in the world at the same time. Right. And then the virus. And I said, you know what? We're living in the end times.
Yeah, I think I remember going to the San Diego Safari Park, which is about an hour or so south of us here. And it's one of those world-renowned, wonderful places where they do a lot of conservation efforts. And they've got a whole area dedicated to the outback. And at that time, I think we were all thinking, this is just insane how much of Australia is on fire. And now in comparison to everything else, the fire seems like just a blip on the radar. And it just our perspective has so shifted because everything just keeps getting bigger and leveling up. Now it's like, oh yes, a whole continent was on fire. That's hardly anything. Did you see what happened next?
Yeah, no, that's so weird because it feels like that was like ages ago that happened. It doesn't feel like even this last.
That's it.
And I remember thinking that I was talking to a friend from Scotland just a couple of days ago, and we actually met each other in Egypt in February around Valentine's Day. And it's just like, you know, Egypt feels like a lifetime ago now, doesn't it? It's like, yeah, it does. It was definitely a simpler time. How are you faring inspirational-wise in all of this?
Well, I would say for me, my experience with quarantine is probably a little different than a lot of other people's, simply because just for my career, everything kind of took off just as the world was crashing. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a juxtaposition of weird things, because we've literally been maybe 1 week in quarantine when I heard that my book was going to be published. And so I had to rush out and start doing things like promotional headshots and things like that, which I literally had to do in my front yard and without the help of my lovely stylist. So I look kind of a wreck, but that's the best I can do on my own. Because we had always joked that, oh, if I ever get my book published, she will get me ready for my official author headshot. And instead I was having to message her and say, okay, do I look acceptable in this? Do I look okay? Do I look serious here? Do I look like I'm doing my portrait? Because that's how most of them ended up looking. And I'm 42. I'm too old to be looking like a high schooler at this point, but that's the only way I know how to pose. So it's been kind of crazy because I did a lot of writing up until, I would say, February. And then in January and into February and early March, I was focusing on the querying process, which is getting that out there to agents and publishers. And so since then, it's really been focusing on the end side of it. So instead of on the creative part, creating something new, it's been on getting it out there, getting it to publishers and agents, and then once the book's released, letting the world know, hey, here's a book and please read it. So I've been focusing on all that, and I keep saying, okay, now I need to go back and have time to actually write, because the book that I have out now, which is called Dibs, I've already finished a sequel to it called Since September. And I keep meaning to write the third book in the series. And every time I do, something else kind of happens that makes me stop and have to go back and focus on those things. So eventually I'm hoping I will have some wonderful inspiration, but to be fully honest, it hasn't happened yet. But time-wise, it really hasn't been that long because Dibs was only written in January and I wrote the sequel within about a week of finishing the first. So it hasn't really been that long since I was in a really intensive writing point. So I think I'm allowed to have a little bit of downtime, but too much more, and I will probably go insane.
Okay, I understand. There's so much to hook onto and talk to about that. So the book that you have out now, your debut novel, Dibs. Tell me a little bit about. You were saying that it was basically, as I said, accepted, and if correct me if I'm wrong, but by breaking rules.
That's right. Yes.
Yes. And how long had you been out with it? I mean, how much had you been putting it out there for agents and other publishers when it got accepted?
Yeah, well, so it was kind of a different path I chose to take with this. And a lot of it came with how Dibs started. I will be fully honest. I am not someone who reads just loads of romance. My normal genre is science fiction and fantasy. Mm-hmm. That's what I generally read. It's what I generally enjoy. And what had happened was I spent several years working on this other novel and had finally finished it in November. And when I had done that, I went ahead and got it out to some of my beta or test readers and was waiting to hear back from that because it's quite a large novel. It's over 100,000 words. And around that time, we're looking Thanksgiving here in the United States and then Christmas. So people really didn't have a whole lot of time to sit down and read. And I was getting antsy looking for more feedback. And at that time, I started connecting with other writers. And when I did, I would offer to do a beta swap or a critique swap. So I would read whatever they had, and I would offer them to read my other novel. And through doing this, I read a lot of women's fiction, things that I probably wouldn't have picked up otherwise. And a lot of it just so frustrated me, both in how the characters acted and the relationships and just how it was described, that I honestly just got fed up and said, I'm going to write my own. So I wrote Dibs in January of this past year. And when I finished it, I sent it to a couple of friends who just said, well, first off, I love it. Second, I need the sequel now, which is why I wrote it shortly after. And because of how quickly it was coming, I didn't want to take the normal process of waiting for an agent to shop it around to a publisher and then possibly be told it'll be another year or two until it comes out, because that's pretty normal in the public game of how long things take. Meanwhile, one of my friends who I'd connected with through the process of doing the beta swapping, she had recently gotten published through Breaking Rules, Jennifer Gordon, her book, Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent. She had gone through that, and I was just in awe because I had read her book in December as a beta swap, and to have her book go from beta to being in people's hands as a physical book just a few months later, it was unbelievable. And I thought, you know what, for this book, that's what I want. I want this to come out quickly. I want to be able to get it in people's hands. And I want to be able to keep moving in the series because, like I said, I wrote it and then the sequel came so quickly afterwards. I didn't want to be sitting with a backlog of books waiting to go to an agent when I wanted to be able to continue writing and continue exploring this series and the characters and the relationships. And going with a smaller publisher that could do a quick turnaround time and get books in people's hands, that was the way for me. So that was a choice that I made because when I actually went with them, I had it with a couple of agents who were still deciding whether or not they wanted to put it in their request more pages pile. Just they're so much slower in the process that I decided that wasn't going to be something that I wouldn't be patient enough to wait for it. Let's just put it that way. So that's how I ended up going with Breaking Rules for that. And yeah, it came out mid-April of this past year.
So would you say that writing this, I mean, let me get this straight in my head. So you're predominantly you would call yourself maybe a fantasy and science fiction writer or reader, and you were frustrated with the way romance novels were written or women's fiction was written. So you kind of, it was it like, what did you see it as a challenge or a dare and say, you know, this can be done in so much of a better way?
Yes, that's very much it, because the thing that I love about fantasy and science fiction, and I think I probably lean more science fiction than anything else, is that they take these real world situations and then they make them so large and take issues and blow them up to the nth degree. And you can really explore human relationships through these things that maybe in a smaller portrait you don't get such a clear picture of the stark choices in humanity. Most of my reading, if you look through my bookshelf, you've got The Expanse, you've got Neil Gaiman, you've got Terry Pratchett. And I love how these guys take these human issues and literally write them across the universe. And that's the kind of stuff I love to read. And whenever I've read things that are geared towards women, not only do they not really have those clear issues and these relationships, which it should be about relationships, but usually it's just things like silly misunderstandings and characters that are cardboard. And I thought, there's no way this whole genre has to be like that. And I'm sure it isn't. And I just haven't read enough of it to know where the good stuff really lies. But what I had read and what I had been exposed to either through friends or through people wanting me to read stuff in that genre that they recommended, I literally did not enjoy it. And I thought, there has to be something better here. And so it kind of was a dare. When I wrote the book, I didn't intend for anyone to even see it. It was mostly just me doing it and just trying to see, hey, can I write a story like this? And when I sent it to my first reader, it was more of a, hey, I know you read romance, you read women's fiction. Tell me, does this fit the genre? Because I literally wasn't sure. What I did, and she loved it and was mad when her Kindle died halfway through the book because she had to wait for it to recharge.
I mean, that's an interesting aspect, and I mean, it's definitely something to touch upon because I remember reading an essay when I was in, because I'm a literary scholar. That's my basic, you know, what I went to school for.
Nice.
So there's obviously, I've read a lot of books and a lot of discussions surrounding it. And I remember we read an essay called Not a Day Without a Book, which was basically a study on women's fiction and how people read women's fiction. And it was all about these. I think they had like 100 different subjects who read more or less only women's fiction. Here, romance novels in Sweden, it has the name Women's Filth, or old Lady Filth is basically what they call it, if you were to translate it literally.
I love it.
And I mean, they're all the same. There's a company. I mean, I think Harlequin is a company that exists in the States as well.
Yeah, I think it's the biggest here.
Yeah. And they're all like 160 pages. And the man who was doing the study, he wanted to know what is it that makes people want to read these books? And he came to the conclusion that they're formulaic, because he threw in a copy of a book that didn't end the way all the other books ended, actually ended in a tragedy where the lovers did not get each other in the end. And
okay.
people hated it. They completely detested it. And it makes me think, like, I actually don't know where I was going with that point, but
I have been told that there are books of how to write romance. I have never touched one. I've never seen one, so I'm probably doing it wrong. But I have been told that you can't actually even query something as romance to an agent or a publisher if it doesn't have the HEA, happily ever after, that it's a requirement for the genre that it's at least happy for now, if not happy ever after. So you don't necessarily have to have the couple walking down the aisle or getting married, but you at least have to have them together and in a good place in their hearts and all that stuff. So I think there is a lot of escapism as far as people wanting to have characters live out fantasies they can't live themselves. And I totally get that. And I don't have any problem with that. And Dibs very much so does that. It's more of just a lot of the times when I've read these books, either earlier or when I was doing what's called looking for comparable titles, so that when you're explaining your book to someone, either a publisher or an agent, you can say, it's like this book and this book. Mm. For me, I was having just the hardest time finding books like that, because every time I started reading one, regardless of whether it was one that is a bestseller or one no one had heard of, I couldn't get into them. I wasn't connecting with the characters. And a lot of it is because it seems like they hit these formulas so hard that the characters are an afterthought. And for mine, I always describe Dibs as a character-driven romance with a bit of banter and bourbon. And that character is absolutely the thing that comes first. We spend a lot of time in the characters' heads and why they're feeling what they're feeling. And it's third person limited, so it's pretty much only the perspective of my main character. Her name is Olivia. So we spent a lot of time in Olivia's head and seeing where she's coming from and why she's feeling the way she's feeling. So even if she's doing something that perhaps someone would look at and say, well, that's not the logical way to react, you understand why she's reacting that way, and it doesn't come across, at least I hope not, as just a silly thing to do to create fake tension and fake drama. Because a lot of the books I've read have people who are having intentional misunderstandings, things like fake fiancés and bears and bets and things like that, that just make no sense at all, because nobody in the real world actually behaves this way.
What I was saying was, like, before we got so rudely interrupted, was that you chose to forgo your genre of choice in order to write romance. But why not keep the romance aspect, the romance tropes in a science fiction or fantasy genre, like, say, like Diana Gabaldon does?
Like her Outlander.
Yeah.
Well, I know there are people who do that, and honestly, for me, because I never really set out to write romance, and when I did, it was more of just, can I do this? What would the story look like? Do I have a story I want to tell here? I actually pulled a lot of things just from my own backstory and my own experiences, and was able to write the story that way. So it is real world set. There's no fantasy element to it other than the fantasy inherent in love stories, because love is always kind of a fantasy. But otherwise, just a little bit about the book that I currently have, that is my literary science fiction. That's the book that I was working on for several years, and the one that I was hoping to get some beta feedback before I started pitching. That one doesn't have any romance in it at all. And actually, it's a little different than a lot of science fiction books, in that all of the characters, at least all the main characters, are all female. And it explores female friendships and other relationships and family relationships a bit. But it is not a romance novel. And honestly, if you would have asked me 6 months ago if I ever wanted to write any romance, I would have just laughed at you, because it was really not something that I felt I had any business writing or any desire to write. Mostly just because I think they always say you should read what you want, or what you want to be writing in, like read a lot in your genre. And I was never drawn to it. I've always been drawn to the science fiction and the fantasy, and even things that kind of fall into the humor and satire. I mentioned Terry Pratchett earlier. One of my other favorites is Carl Hiaasen and his crazy books that are over the top. Those are the kind of things that I enjoy reading. And honestly, when I was trying to find any kind of romance book that I enjoyed, all the ones that I'd read had been ones I'd been given because someone had said, oh, you will enjoy this, or it's one of my favorites, and I would check it out. And up until recently, I've always been one of those readers who, even if I'm hating the book, I will finish it out of spite, just to say that I finished it, just to give it a chance to redeem itself. And I never really got into any of those books, even the ones that are the highest rated and the most well-loved. I think probably the exception would be the Sookie Stackhouse books by Charlene Harris, the Dead Until Dark, the True Blood. And I enjoyed those. And they do have quite a bit of romance, but there's definitely, that's more of the paranormal romance. And those I've enjoyed. But as far as more traditional romance, I've really not gotten into it. So I'm sure I would probably enjoy a science fiction book that has that, if it's primarily a science fiction that has those other elements. But generally, it's not the romance that's drawn me to the books. It's been those other elements. And the romance is like the bonus prize with the meal.
Yeah. And I think that there's actually a fine line, and going back to the literary scholar portion of it, there's a fine line. The novel in itself is a mix of styles and genres. That is what kind of gave birth to the novel in the 18th century. But there is somewhere an unwritten rule that you are not allowed, once the novel was created and all the genres were created after that, there was like an unwritten rule, is that you are not allowed to mix the tropes of various genres, just like a band is not allowed to play different types of music.
Right. And why is that? Did they ever give you an explanation in your studies why you couldn't blur those lines, and why you couldn't pull tropes from one and use them in another context?
I think it's because there's no definite answer here, but what scholars usually discuss is the fact that it kind of belies the author-reader trust. You know, this author because I am familiar with his work. This is what he does, and this is the genre he is in. He can also, like Stephen King, he's obviously written fantasy and he's written horror, but I don't expect horror elements in a Stephen King book in his fantasy stories. I mean, they can be dark and they can be scary, but the actual, like, you don't mix, say, Eyes of the Dragon with It. You can't have like an it type of character in the Eyes of the Dragon because the quality drops. I don't know if I believe. I don't know if I wholeheartedly believe in that, because I believe that there are authors that are exceptional at using tropes from different styles. I think Diana Gabaldon does a great job with the Outlander series, using fantasy, science fiction, historical fiction mixed with romance. Mm-hmm. But I think I don't know.
Yeah, and it's funny because my sister has always been a big Stephen King fan, and she's the one who talked me into reading it when I was initially too young and too scared, and I said, I won't do horror because I would actually like to sleep at night.
Yeah.
She had me read were some of the short stories that weren't as scary, but he's definitely one of my favorite authors, and I love the Dark Tower series, but I'm interested, would that be considered horror or fantasy? Because there's a little bit of both.
I think they consider it dark fantasy, which to me is a little bit of a like a gray zone of a genre. Dark fantasy, obviously, because I always used to think that dark fantasy and grim dark were similar in styles. But
yeah, I can see that.
But dark fantasy has more leans toward having, you know, supernatural horror elements, and there is a general sense of malaise and sorrow in it.
Well, and in that case, that everything's going 19, to know that everything's going wrong and what happens when you start breaking beams. So
yeah,
I know that that's one of my favorite series, and even the stuff that he wrote with Peter Straub that kind of ties into that. Yeah. And Straub is definitely more known for just straight out horror. So that's one of those things where you go, okay, well, if you're going to classify it, where do you classify it, and who's making that determination? Is it the author? Is it the publisher? Is it the general audience consensus? Is there a literary professor somewhere who's classifying it and they've got the final word? I just know that for me, I like to know what I'm getting into, and I appreciate then when it's labeled clearly, because if I'm expecting a romance and it's really not a romance, or if I'm expecting something that's fantasy and it ends up being more horror and I've got nightmares, then I'm going to be sad.
Yeah, and I think that somewhere in between, and I'd like to, and I think most literary scholars like to put the blame on publishers and librarians.
Oh, never blame librarians. My mother was a librarian, so I will always come to her, defend her, and say she never did anything wrong, and if it was, somebody else in the shelf did, because people are off with books.
Yeah, I think it has to do with an innate need for people to be able to classify things.
Well, I think that's an important thing, and I was actually going to mention. So I write romance under Allison Martine, and there's a specific reason I do that, partially because my actual legal name is not nearly as romantic sounding. When I write the literary science fiction, I write under A.M. Hubbard. And Hubbard is my last name, and most people, who, when they hear Hubbard, they either think Old Mother Hubbard, which is not really romantic, no. Or they think Hubbard, and they get into the Dianetics and Scientology stuff, which isn't really where romance should go either,
no.
But he's a heavyweight for science fiction, so I've always joked that if my book ends up shelved next to his in the science fiction section, and someone mistakenly picks it up thinking it's somehow related to his, I'm going to be laughing all the way to the bank.
Yeah.
And run with it. But it's also helping to distinguish the two types of books that I write, so that there's never going to be a secret that they're both me. But one of them, if it's Allison Martine, it is romance. If it's A.M. Hubbard, it's going to be science fiction.
I think that's a very smart way, and obviously a very shrewd business model, piggybacking on L. Ron Hubbard. I don't think anybody ever accused L. Ron Hubbard of being a romantic either, so.
Not that I've known of. He's probably some other things, but no romance has ever crossed that path.
No, exactly. It's interesting. This is a very interesting discussion to have, because I was talking to Jennifer Gordon about that, about because oftentimes when I speak to female authors, women writers, we talk about like their inspiration, and it's always the same. It's mostly Stephen King, and it's all these, and I oftentimes wonder And it seems like you have a little bit of a, maybe have a thought about this, but where are the inspirational women in writing? Because especially like in horror or in fan, I mean, there are more in fantasy. We have Ursula K. Le Guin.
I loved Ursula K. Le Guin when I was in like high school. I remember having a stack of her books next to my bed.
So what women have you seen as your guiding lights, your torches in the dark when writing?
Well, I would say growing up, I was a huge Anne Rice fan, to my mother's chagrin. I remember her hating that I was reading Anne Rice and her giving me a copy of a John Irving novel instead because she thought Anne Rice was highly inappropriate and I shouldn't have been reading her. And I think she forgot what was in the John Irving books because
yeah.
I went back and I said, Mother, do you remember that this happened? This happened, and then a child dies. I won't say which book it was, so I won't give away which one. So any spoilers for a 30-plus-year-old book, actually probably 40 or 50 years old at this point. But still, I think she just thought, well, it has vampires, and it must be inappropriate, and didn't really remember that there was plenty of inappropriate stuff in John Irving's stuff as well. So I would say big time I was an Anne Rice reader when I was younger. And then some of the stuff that's come out most recently in science fiction and fantasy, some of my favorites have all been written by women. The Night Circus by Erin Morgenstern is mm-hmm. just beautiful. And I recently read Gideon the Ninth by Tamsin Muir, also just a gorgeous book. And I got to hear that one on Audible, which was very fun because the narrator was just amazing. But it led me to totally picture the character wrong because the voice in my head matched Valkyrie from Thor Ragnarok. So yeah. I was picturing Tessa Thompson the whole time. And when I got a full description of the character and it's a redhead girl and I'm going, well, that's not her. I don't care. I'm still picturing Valkyrie. Especially because the character was still a badass with a couple of swords. And I thought she was just amazing. And I've also really enjoyed the Anne Leckie series, the ancillary series. I don't know if you've read any of that.
No, those I haven't read. No.
those are amazing, and she also does a lot of interesting stuff with gender because everything in her books is gender neutral, but they always use female pronouns.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Character relationships, it's very, everybody's always a daughter or a mother, and everything from there on is kind of confusing because you're trying to picture these relationships in terms of our normal binary, and it just doesn't translate. And once you kind of set that aside and go, this is her world and I'm going to go with it, it just becomes this more beautiful and rich term. And I've read three of hers plus another one that's kind of attached to that, but not in the same ancillary series. And I can't recommend them enough. I know they've won enough awards, so they don't really need my stamp of approval, but I absolutely loved her stuff.
Well, I mean, at least if nothing else, people who are listening to this might not have heard of her. So that's a recommendation in itself. So when you thought of writing your own romance, where did you go for inspiration and start, or did you just start writing from scratch?
Well, a lot of it was just stuff from my own life that I kind of reimagined. And I'm sure everyone has done this where they go, if only things had fallen out a little differently or things had happened slightly differently in terms of time, or in terms of who was where at what time, what could have happened? So it definitely starts with some of my own backstory and some of my own life experiences, and then just rearranging them a little bit for some narrative clarity, and then inserting a definitely fantasy-inspired love interest and going from there to create kind of a dream man that falls for our main character in a way that hopefully people will enjoy falling in love with them as they fall in love.
And when you were done, was it obvious that there was going to be a follow-up? Yeah, I think Jennifer and I were talking about when we spoke to each other about noisy characters, characters who want to be heard and say, like, no, there's more here. I'm going to stick around for a bit, and you're going to write more.
Yeah, and that was, it was actually very funny because when Dibs originally finished, there was an epilogue. And it wasn't a long epilogue, but it basically kind of covered what would happen over the next year or so of the characters' lives. And I figured, okay, I've done this. I've gotten out of my system. I can go back to writing the stuff that I'm supposed to be writing or the mm-hmm. books that I'm supposed to be doing. And the first few people who read it with the epilogue, and And because I kept getting asked for the sequel by some of these readers, I realized, okay, I will write a sequel. But originally, I didn't plan to write the sequel that I did. I planned to take a secondary character, elevate her to the main character, and have a love story for her. So another situation with another main character where our main character from Dibs falls into the background would still be there, but it would no longer be her voice and her story. Well, I sat down to write it, and the first couple things that started happening were the main character still. And I realized, you know what? Her story and the story of this couple with Adam and Olivia, it wasn't done. So I ended up writing more for them and what happens for them in the next year after Dibs takes place, and ended up going back then to Dibs and striking the epilogue, even after it had already gotten to the publisher. But I said, please pull back. I wrote one more line to tie it up and pulled out the epilogue, because what happened in the epilogue then became an entire other book that I had no plan to write. So that absolutely is what happened, because I realized that their story still had a lot more to say, and that most love stories don't just stop the minute the couple kisses and connects. There's still so much more for them. So that's what Since September is really about. It's their story going forward. But I do plan for the third one to actually do what I planned to do the first time, which is move on to a secondary character and let somebody else take the spotlight. And I already have complaints, people saying, no, you're not done with them. I need to see them have babies and buy houses and get completely domestic. I just said, guys, that's boring. I don't need to read that. At least not as my main plot. Can I please move on? So hopefully they will like whatever else I write and will forgive me for not making them turn into an episode of the Learning Channel as they go house hunting or something.
If nothing else, there's grounds for fan fiction there.
Yeah.
Somebody can write fan fiction books. And becoming part of the Breaking Rules family, how did that happen?
Well, most of that was through Jennifer Gordon, just because she and I had already connected as beta readers. And it was actually quite funny, because I had given her my literary sci-fi novel, and she had given me Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent. And I read hers right away, and she didn't get a chance to read mine right away because she ended up going to Madrid and getting all of her publication stuff happening. So she's checking final copies and proofs and was telling me, I will get back to it, I promise. And ultimately I said to her, I do want you to read, but I did a quick manuscript swap and said, don't read this right now. I want you to read this and tell me what you think. And so she read it and she fell in love with Dibs. And she was the one who said, you need to be submitting this to Breaking Rules. You need to get this in here. So that's how that all went down. So my letter to the publisher very obviously name dropped Jennifer all through it. And I'm sure that had something to do with it getting seen right away, just because Jennifer is so highly regarded there. And her experience was just really inspirational for me.
Sounds good. And are you still shopping your science fiction book around, or is that kind of like on the shelf right now?
Oh, it's not on the shelf. It's been kind of crazy because I think I mentioned at the beginning of our talk here that my career kind of took off right when quarantine happened. So there's inverse thing that the worse the world happens, the better things go in my career, which is proof to me the world really is ending, because all of this stuff happening so wonderfully can't go on. So I am waiting for the monkeys that stole the vials in India to announce their plan to take over the world in the next couple weeks. But seriously, about 24 hours, maybe 48 hours after I got the contract for Dibs from Breaking Rules, an agent who had liked my pitch from my literary sci-fi during PitMad back in March. So had at that point was a few pages of the book and a query letter. She asked for the full manuscript, and then a few weeks later she called and offered representation. So I'm now represented by Naomi Davis with Bookends Literary for Garibaldi Waltz, and she is currently shopping it to a lot of publishers, but that only happened within the past couple weeks, so I'm still waiting to hear back what's going to happen and who's going to take that. And I hope the answer is somebody, but this whole process is very new to me, so I don't really know how long to expect before I start hearing answers.
So did you, I mean, is this, was this your first foray into writing, or had you been writing for a while before even considering? I mean, did you do short stories? Did you do, have you done the anthology bit with independent publishers at all, or?
I've really been writing since I was a little kid, and I did a lot of short stories and things like that, and won awards as I was a child in local competitions, things like that. There's a competition locally called the Michael J. Rostin competition. I don't think it exists anymore, but it was one only for the city of Anaheim, where I grew up here in California. And I entered that several times, and I know I won when I was a fifth grader, and then again when I was a junior in high school. And I always wanted to be a writer, but that wasn't really the path I thought would be sustainable. So even though I went to college on a writing scholarship from a local charity organization called the Udall Club, I ended up getting a poli sci degree and then going on to law school, and I practiced as an attorney here in California for 10 years. But the always to write, but there's really no job you go get where you become a novelist. That's just not how it works. You don't sit down and get a paycheck to do it. You need something else to sustain it. So while I was an attorney, I continued to write, and it wasn't until that I started my family that I had more time to kind of write because I wasn't in a 9-to-5 office job. And I actually had written a child's book, so middle grade fiction, but it was a little long for middle grade fiction. It was around 70,000 words. And shopping that, but kind of set it aside because I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do with it. And eventually just kind of put that one on the back burner when I started writing the literary sci-fi called The Garibaldi Waltz. That's the one I've been working on for the past several years. And that's the one that I said, okay, this is the one I'm going to buckle down and figure out this whole publishing business thing. I'm going to figure out how to query. I'm going to figure out how to get an agent. And that's what led me to the PitMed process, because that was someone who was willing to kind of talk you through, here's how to write a query letter, here's how to get agents' attention. And who knew that you could pitch a book on Twitter? That's kind of a crazy thing, but
Yeah,
that's how,
right.
yeah, that's how I got my agent, was through a pitch on Twitter, which led to a query, which led to getting the full manuscript.
And did you, I mean, so you were, at least you were well aware of how to write and everything like that. So but let's see, now I kind of lost my train of thought there.
Done like anthologies or anything, and I had back in college, but beyond that, I did do a lot of short story for a smaller website called Scribophile, where it's basically just other writers reading and giving feedback. And I found that really helped write things like flash fiction and short stories, but none of them were up to the level where I ever would have felt comfortable submitting them anywhere, because most of them were done just as exercises. And I would use what I learned in the exercises and apply it to the longer fiction.
So you were mentioning, well, I should mention this because I always do whenever his name comes up. Actually, there's two authors' names. Whenever they come up, I always have to mention it. It's Terry Pratchett and H.P. Lovecraft. Terry Pratchett is also one of my personal favorites, and I have a whole shelf in my bookshelf that is dedicated to Terry Pratchett. It's my Pratchett shelf.
And I had several until I sold them to our local bookstore, which made me super sad, but I realized they were all going to get rehomed and someone else could fall in love with them. And I did not have any more space for any more Terry Pratchett.
Yeah, no, but yeah, my shelf contains like the CDs with the music from, well,
Oh, no.
the Discworld music and all the diaries that were published and everything like that. But it's a work in progress. It's not done. But speaking of Pratchett, and you mentioned Gaiman as well, is your science fiction more towards that kind of, like, it's not, I wouldn't say that Gaiman or Pratchett are lighthearted in their writing, but there is an element of comedy to it.
Yes, there's definitely humor. I don't think I can write anything without there being humor in there, whether I mean to or not. So it's not a comedy the way I know it's hard to sometimes really pigeonhole what Terry Pratchett does, because there's the element of humor, but it's also the humor that makes you sad for humanity at the same time. And that's not really how my humor comes across, I don't think, but there's always definitely an element of humor and lightheartedness through things, but there's then also other themes that play a big part in it. And when I was trying to figure out what genre to even call the literary science fiction, it was really kind of a challenge because I always saw it as science fiction that was really fantasy, or fantasy that was wearing science fiction clothes. Because it is not a hard sci-fi. It's not like a Robin Cook or a Michael Crichton where there's going to be a DNA challenge at the end or something like that. And it was something that had been kind of bandied around as I was querying it to figure out where it really fit, because it's not set in a world. When people hear fantasy, they automatically go to something like Tolkien, and you think of elves and orcs and things like that. That's not the kind of book it is at all. If anything, it's slightly closer to something like Charles de Lint. I don't know if you're familiar with his stuff.
Green Mantle is one of my favorite books.
Yes. So it's slightly closer to that as far as we're set in much more of a real world place. But if anything, in some ways, it resembles a little bit of Doctor Who, where you've got someone who's explaining space-time continuum as wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey. That's the kind of stuff we're dealing with. But it is set present day, it is set real world, and then things happen from there that take us to places that the real world normally shouldn't go.
Sounds a little bit like Jack L. Chalker, who is kind of like that, which is he definitely mixes science fiction. I always assumed that his books, when I saw them, were fantasy books, but they're actually science fiction books. But they have a strong fantasy element in them. And also very absurd. And I think that's where kind of the humor for Chalker comes in. It's the whole absurd part of it, kind of like Robert Rankin, who is very much like Terry Pratchett, and he calls it far-fetched fiction. And I think that's a very good sub-genre name.
I love that, and I feel like the idea of figuring out what the genres are is almost harder than figuring out what the title is half the time. Yeah. When I was trying to figure this out, one of the beta readers I had, I am forever indebted to him, to my friend Aaron Robleski. He read mine, and he said, "Well, did you think of a comp for this as Donnie Darko?" And I said, "What?" Because it's one of my favorite movies, and it had never occurred to me that there was any similarity, but as soon as he pointed it out, I couldn't unsee it. And so I ended up pitching the book as Donnie Darko meets Sphere, but all female characters.
Yeah. Okay.
That's really where it is, and those two books, or those two, one's a movie and one's a book, have really nothing in common, and somehow my book kind of falls right in between them. And then, like I said, with strong female characters, that was something that I wanted to do, because it's often the case when you're reading science fiction or fantasy, the female characters, if they're anything but a love interest, it's rare. And then if they are, it's usually a 18 to 20 year old single female who is wielding a sword or a laser gun of some sort. And my main character in my literary science fiction is a mom. She's got a toddler with her through most of the story.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I completely agree. Finding the genre of it overall is difficult. And I tried to kind of pen my own name for a fantasy genre as a kind of like a dystopian fantasy, where everything is just, it's fantasy, set in a fantasy world, but with a great portion of realism in it. Because what I always found so annoying is that you have like a farm boy, he finds a sword, and all of a sudden he can fight with it. He can kill a dragon, whereas that would never happen for real. And here in Sweden, that kind of dark fantasy, which is, I would call it, it would be if Ingmar Bergman directed a fantasy movie. That's kind of like how I see it. And in Sweden, that tradition is very strong. There are very few Swedish fantasy authors, and right now there are none. But there were.
There are none at all?
No. Well, there are some, and I think they're more on the indie field, but there are no real published ones anymore, because they've all stopped or they've gone off to write horror or something else. But
wow, okay.
One of the ones that was at the forefront of it, there were two actually that were strong. They were kind of like, I mean, a lot of them had to do with like, what is it like to live in, what would it be like to live in a medieval society, but then there's magic, or there are other beasts in this world. Right. And they were talking about there's misery, there's drunkenness, there's rape, people are filthy, people are dirt poor. And there's always
well, that's
the sense,
pretty accurate, yes.
And there's like this the sense of not being able to lift yourself out of it, and
that dread, that existential dread that would come in with something like that.
Yeah, exactly, and that's something that you very rarely see in fantasy stories. So that was a dystopian fantasy. Is something that I think, and I mean, also the kind of descriptions of people being hurt, people being injured, and what it actually feels like to have a sword pierce your body, like the description of that when it happens, because that's something that you rarely see in fantasy either.
No, because the people who are doing the perspective, they're the one wielding the sword and going off and fighting their epic quests, and maybe they have merely a flesh wound, but they don't end up having something that actually brings any kind of real damage.
Yeah.
Well, and because I absolutely love things like I have entire I have entire bookshelves on Goodreads. I don't know if you use Goodreads.
Yeah, I do.
But I you get to label your own shelves, so that's kind of fun. So I have an entire one that I just call Apocalyptica, because I love reading stories about how the world is going to end, because everyone has a different idea about it. So sometimes it's interesting trying to decide, well, does this really fit there? Because there's an entire society that happens in that. So something like A Handmaid's Tale would be considered that, because what a society should be has already crumbled into this new society.
Yeah.
And others are actually stories that take place as the world is ending. Something like World War Z, where, there we go, it's zombies. And I know everybody wants zombies in this current apocalypse, and we haven't gotten any yet, which I'm fine with. I can wait on zombies.
Yeah, well, if you read Max Brooks' first book, The Zombie Survival Guide, he kind of hints that there have been zombies already. It's just that they're masked as swine flu or bird flu.
Well, I'm sure he would probably throw coronavirus in there as well.
Probably.
He was just too soon with it. He pulled the trigger on that one too soon. He had to wait for the actual apocalypse to get here to write his novel.
Yes. Indeed. Well, Allison, our time is coming to a close. Do you have anything that you would like to plug apart from your book, Dibs? Do you have like a release date on the follow-up at all? Or?
Well, since September, I have planned to launch in September, just so I remember when it is, because it's there in the title. So Since September should be coming out in September, if I can actually get myself back to going through and editing it and making sure it's ready to go. And then hopefully I'll be able to write the third in the series, which does not have a title because right now it's basically just a few pages of notes. Mm. But anyway, welcome to check out my website on Facebook. If you just look for Allison Martin, author. So it's like Martin, but with an E on the end.
Yeah, we'll link all that in the show notes. Do you have a Twitter or an Instagram you would like to plug as well?
Yeah, my Twitter is a fictional Hubbard, so a fictional hub one.
Mm-hmm.
Under Instagram, I'll click on it just to see. Yeah, that's a fictional Hubbard also. So a_fictional_Hubbard.
Mm. Very cool. I would like you. I'd like to thank you for coming on, and I hope that that Hubbard will come on once the science fiction book is ready and ready to be published.
And thank you for having me. I've had a great time talking with you.
Yeah, and we could probably do this even longer if we had the time. There's so much to discuss. I think it's always interesting to kind of like this free form, just kind of like talk about, you know, everything that has to do with writing and creating
and comparing bookshelves.
Absolutely. Well, Allison, thank you very much again for coming on, and I hope to hear from you more in the future.
Sounds great. Have a good one.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
And we're back. Great talk with Allison Martin. A lot of interesting stuff that we talked about. Literary scholarship as well. Stuff like that. Very interesting. Very fun to talk about. And of course, there are various ideas and thoughts on all these different types of subjects that we're talking about. I'd like to thank Allison for coming on. I would also like to thank John Haltman, who provided the music today. And I'd also like to thank everyone for listening. Continue to listen, continue to like, share this podcast so that more can reap the benefits of what we're talking about. Yes, so follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those good things. Have a nice day, and I'm going to enjoy this sunny weather that we have here in my part of the world for a little while longer. Have a good time. See you next time.